Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host again for this edition. I want to return to the conflict in Ukraine this week, though there's plenty of other news I could cover. I apologize again for not having had the time to get out and arrange local interviews, as I'm still in the process of moving my studio. And by the way, this station's antenna and transmitter will also be moving, and we could really use your financial support so that we can not only move, but hopefully upgrade our equipment. You can donate at WCRSFM.org for both stations. I feel, though, that the global conflict in Ukraine is rather pivotal on a number of ways. It is the latest test of imperialism on the part of the U.S. and some of its Western allies, and it may bring the downfall of the Russian regime, which could be both good and bad in terms of its consequences. Surely the effects on global commodities will be significant, especially with regard to fossil fuels and grains, and that may be felt at the gas pumps and in the grocery stores here to a lesser extent, but it will affect Europe far more severely, and it's already having severe consequences in Africa, where impoverished nations are dependent on Ukrainian wheat supplies. The interconnectedness of global economies could be a source of resilience, but under capitalism, we are seeing its many vulnerabilities. Instead, it is also the latest test of our fragmented and oft tragically dormant peace movement, not just here, but around the world. We know there have been some protests in Russia, but by and large the U.S., the left, has been mostly on board with the U.S. strategy of arming Ukraine and pushing for an outright victory rather than an amicable settlement that satisfies some or any of Russia's concerns, really. Instead, Russia is portrayed two-dimensionally as a consummate villain, and Ukraine as the innocent victim, with its president, who has become largely an artifact of U.S. foreign policy interests, as some kind of a hero. The left's analysis lacks nuance and perspective in that regard, and it seems we've forgotten the lessons of the U.S. war in Iraq, which was also unnecessary and premised upon fictions. While the Russian invasion is certainly no fiction, and to Ukrainians, civilians being bombed or tortured or executed, analytical nuances are of no consequence or relevance, I'm sure, and I have said, and will say here again, that I think Putin should be prosecuted by the World Court for what is clearly colossal crime. But we can't ignore the fact that this war was preventable and that Putin's transgressions were not only predictable, but were overtly and honestly foretold both by Putin himself and by a portion of the U.S. intelligence community, which had been warning against this policy trajectory for many years and several presidential administrations. In this edition, we'll hear once again from economist Richard Wolff and historian Jeffrey Sachs, giving once again an overview of the situation and its present historical context, and discussing its implications. And we'll start with Richard Wolff, who in this interview discusses the economic motivations and impacts of the U.S.-Russia war in Ukraine.
Thank you guys for tuning in today, and welcome to another episode of The Source. I'm your host, Zan Raza, and today I'll be talking to Professor Richard Wolff about the economics of the Ukraine war. Professor Richard Wolff is the founder of Democracy at Work and professor emeritus of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's the author of many books, the latest being When Capitalism Can Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. Professor Richard Wolff, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Sarah Wagenknecht, left-wing politician and member of the German parliament, caused a political and media uproar last year in Germany when she stated that Germany and its allies are waging an economic war against Russia. How would you classify the West's economic policy towards Russia since the war began?
Well, I think that the problem of the war, the Ukraine war, can be handled this way. There are two wars. One war is military and involves Russia and Ukraine. There it is pretty clear that one of the two sides is better equipped, larger, and I mean, there's really not much of a contest on the military scale unless you are prepared to confront Russia yourself. You are watching a war that is being won by one side and lost by the other. And that's true whether or not you fill the Ukrainian weapons gap with external weapons. That slows the process, but it does not change. And the West understood that, and so the West undertook a second different war. And in that case, we have the same kind of imbalance. in the sense that the United States and Western Europe and Japan on the one side waging economic war against Russia. Many people do not understand that that is the same lopsided war in economic terms that the other one is in military. So let me give you a statistic that more people should understand. In economics, we use something called the GDP, the gross domestic product. It gives you a rough idea of the size of an economy. It measures literally the total output of goods and services in one calendar year. The most recent year for Russia, the GDP of Russia is $1.5 trillion. On the other side is the United States, whose most recent GDP is $21 trillion. In other words, this is a struggle, economically speaking, an economic war waged by sanctions and counter sanctions that we all know about. This is a war between David and Goliath, and you can all figure out who's on which side in this arrangement. If you then add the countries of Europe, Germany, France, Britain, Italy, to the United States, then it becomes closer to a 30-to-1 ratio of economic wealth. That is as lopsided an economic war as the military war is, only in reverse. The mystery is why it has not succeeded. Why, after nearly a year of war, the promised, and I mean it, promised by the West, by our President Biden, among others, that this would destroy Russia as an economic entity, that they would be prostrate, that the ruble would be worthless in international currency exchange, that the economy would have collapsed. All of that was wrong. None of that has happened. And the mistake in the West was not understanding that the global economy has changed and the dominance of the United States, which was already slipping for some decades, has now been exposed and revealed as far less of an economic power than it was imagining itself to be. Russia turned out to have very important allies. Chief of them, the People's Republic of China. Just again, to keep the statistic in everyone's mind, the most recent GDP of China is $17.5 trillion. Therefore, catching up to the United States and many, many, many times larger than Russia. Given China and India and Turkey and Iran and other supports that Russia has been able to get, the predictions were wrong. And we now face a kind of stalemate situation because the predicted dominance of the United States, which it had gotten used to for 75 years since the end of World War II, is now over. And it's going to take a lot of time before the different people and blocks in the world adjust to this. But I can leave you with an economist's warning. Countries around the world, and this includes every country in Europe, better rethink their strategic decisions because the world has changed and it will not go back. This genie cannot go back in the bottle. This is a new situation and will have enormous ramifications.
I want to focus right now exclusively on the impact on Russia. Could you first talk about what measures Western countries, in particular the U.S., took to isolate Russia, and then talk about whether how it impacted the economy of Russia?
Sure. Every kind of sanction imaginable has been tried here against Russia. That is, Russia has been subject to sanctions before. This is not the first time. There is experience with sanctioning Russia going back at least 15, 20 years. I'm talking legal public sanctions. Illegal under the table, that's an even longer, older story. That goes back to the days of the Soviet Union and so on. But this has been an attempt to learn from the sanctions applied against Cuba, Iran, China, to do it all, to try to come together and do it all. So, for example, about $300 billion worth of currency reserves kept in Western banks and so forth by the Russians to support their currency was seized. The Russians are denied access to what is Russian property. It should be kept in mind what this means, because this is a precedent. Whether the people who did it intended it as a precedent or not, the notion that we live in a global economy run by the United States, which observes the rules of private property, that is over. There is no private property rule. It is trumped by the economic nationalism that has replaced neoliberal globalization as the dominant ideology here in the United States. The Russians were denied use of the international payments system called the SWIFT. That's just an acronym, the SWIFT system. That makes it much more difficult to arrange payments. It's a way of interfering and hobbling international trade. Then sanctions were put against individuals, against companies. Enormous pressure, public and private, was put on American corporations. And by the way, in other countries, this was also done. But I'm talking mostly here about the United States. That's what I know best. And so American companies sold their subordinate companies in Russia to other companies, other international companies, in some cases, other Russian companies in still others. The United States has threatened other countries and other companies around the world with sanctions if they do trade with Russia. Somebody, nobody knows who, somebody blew up the pipeline in the North Sea. Embargoes against oil and gas, in some cases transported by sea, in some cases transported by land, pipeline, and so on, shutting off the export of energy, which is a major support for the Russian economy. All in all, if Russia had not had major allies in the world, these measures would have reasonably hobbled in a very short time the Russian economy. It didn't do that, but the major reason is that the Russians had developed, far better than most of us who observe these situations understood, and clearly better than the West understood, had developed relationships above all with China and India, but other countries as well, that allowed them basically, not to put a long face on this, but to substitute relationships with Asia, Africa, and Latin America that were taken together able to stifle most of what the West sought. So, for example, if you measure over the last 12 months the amount of damage suffered by an economy in terms of slowing production and so on, there is a shrinkage in Russia, but it is actually not as big as the shrinkage in the United States and Western Europe. So the irony, it's remarkable. The irony is that, yes, the war has been an enormous expenditure here in the United States. If you take all the commitments together, it's over $100 billion, which makes it the most expensive war in recent memory. And it's less than a year old, so who knows? But the impact of the war has been to do damage globally and to do as much damage to the West as to Russia. Now, Russia is a much smaller economy, so that it has less resources to cope. So it is causing trouble inside Russia. That's clear. They are having to divert resources from producing for the civilian sector to producing war materials. But nothing compared to the collapse that was predicted by the West has happened. And unless something changes, there's no prospect of that happening this year either. Meanwhile, the inflation, the rising interest rates in the West are a much more serious threat to the economy of the West than this war has proven to be to the economy of Russia.
Just to make a counter argument, some would say that it's not about achieving economic objectives. It's about setting a tone. It's about moral significance. How would you comment on that, for example, when people would argue that sanctions in this case, even if they didn't work, showed our moral significance in terms of protecting freedom and democracy?
I must say I find it extraordinary, such an argument. Even here in the United States, you would have a difficulty with that argument from both the right wing and the left wing, neither of which would accept such an argument. Remember, I'm talking from the United States. Here's our record as a nation when it comes to a rules-based international order or authoritarian government or large countries invading small countries, all of that kind of talk that what you just said refers to. The United States invaded Korea. It's a small country. The United States invaded Vietnam. It's a small country. The United States invaded Afghanistan. It's one of the poorest countries on the face of the earth and a small country. The United States invaded Iraq. I could go on, in Libya and so forth. We have a history as a nation. If there are rules-based international order, then the rule that we can identify is the United States does what it wants to do in the last 75 years, and either the United Nations goes along or it doesn't, but it doesn't really matter. And people like me who are close to the American government in terms of my personal life and my personal friendships, it doesn't enter into their mind. Therefore, suddenly to be outraged when another country, in big country relatively, invades a small one relatively, to be all excited about taking moral positions, wow, that requires a level of blindness and gullibility and one-sidedness that's a little embarrassing to witness, let alone to repeat.
You mentioned the impact on Europe and the United States. Could you elaborate on that in terms of the economic impact and its having also on the infrastructure and energy infrastructure, etc.?
Yes, well, I mean, the most immediate and obvious has been the impact on energy prices, number one. That impacts Europe, not the United States. So that puts the United States in a bizarre situation, but it's even more bizarre for you in Europe, for the Europeans, because the United States takes the lead in applying sanctions whose impact is much more severe on the economy of Europe than on the United States. One would have thought, to the degree that economic considerations are important, and they always are, more or less, that the leadership would have been taken by Europe, since they have to live with the negative consequences. The United States has its own sources of energy, could care less whether Russia does or doesn't export. I mean, it has implications on global prices, and that's important, but it's not the kind of impact that you're seeing all across Western Europe, and particularly in the countries that did rely on cheap energy from Russia. But I would stress that the impacts here go far beyond the immediate question of inflation stimulated by rising energy prices. There were other factors, and they are just as important. They're related to the war in Iraq, so it's not a separate matter, but they are also distinct. And here's the basic one. There is an empire that is declining. If you look at the 19th and 20th century, whatever else you say, you notice, especially as the 19th century moves into the 20th century, that the dominant empire of those two centuries, the British Empire, was declining, especially in the 20th century. It was being challenged by the United States, a former colony, by Germany, trying, as it always did, to match British capitalism, and by Japan emerging later. And you still had the competing colonial systems, the French, the Russian, the Dutch, and so on. But the British Empire was declining. World Wars I and II removed the German and Japanese competitors, leaving the field to the United States. We are now in a post-peak American Empire phase. That's what I referred to before. People have begun, but only begun, to understand the macro picture here. This is a declining empire. The Chinese are the obvious rising empire. China, it has to be understood, is the first serious economic competitor to the United States in nearly a century. The American dominance emerges in World War I and the interwar period and becomes clear to everyone with end of World War II. Russia was never an economic competitor. That's why I gave you the statistic, $1.5 trillion, $21 trillion. I mean, that's not the same number at all points, but the idea is Russia may have had a nuclear weapon and may have been a serious military problem, but it was never an economic competitor. For that, we have to wait for China. China's GDP, in case anyone wonders, the $17 trillion, that's a competitor for the United States. And everything that is happening now has to be contextualized as part of that struggle. That's why it should have been clear before that Russia would turn to China for all kinds of assistance, probably made the decision, I wouldn't know, but probably made the decision to move into Ukraine, having already worked out with China what they would or wouldn't do as allies. In other words, we have a new situation. For most of the last 75 years, any country, anywhere, where the local political leadership wanted to break out of the U.S. hegemony capitalist world economy was pretty quickly smashed and crushed because they had nowhere else to go. You have to work with global capitalism. It is highly unequal as a system. The United States sits at the top politically, economically, and militarily. What are you going to do? You have no option. And the United States made it very clear. If you don't listen to us politically, we will squeeze you economically. If you do not listen to that, we will attack you. It's your choice, but we will defeat what you are doing, and you can only choose which way you're going to be defeated. If you want an example, look at Cuba. That's how they dealt with Cuba, and they dealt more or less everybody. There is now a change. This change, I cannot exaggerate this. Country after country is now experimenting. The smallest countries of Africa, the smallest countries of Latin America are experimenting in this new world. They are dealing with the People's Republic of China. By the way, they're dealing with Russia too. Russia is able to sell oil and gas in limited quantities to small, poorer countries because everybody has a choice now. The United States and Western Europe are desperately trying to hold on to a dominance that is shrinking with each passing week. They can continue to pretend to themselves and to the world that they are still in charge, but this sanction war and its failure so far is a major blow, and they are going to have to adjust to the changing world just like everybody else.
I also want to talk about the effect military spending has been having on the United States itself. Billions of billions of dollars are going in military aid to Ukraine. Last I heard that the amount of aid that's been sent to Ukraine in 2022 is more than the budget of the State Department. What effects is all of this military aid having on the United States itself?
Well, let me quote you back to you. So far, this is all justified in grandiose, patriotic matters of principle. If you know anything about American politics, when a politician in this country talks about principle, my advice is reach into your back pocket, hold on to your wallet, because someone is about to remove the money that was in it. And Americans make that joke all the time. So most Americans are not much fooled by this business either. Here's the reality that is hidden from the public. If you suddenly have in this country a devastating inflation running 8, 9, 10% per year, which is what we had starting in the latter part of 2021 and basically running across 2022, pretty soon you're going to have trouble, especially if the rate of the rising wages is much behind the rate of rising prices. And in our country here in the United States, rising wages have rarely been more than half the rate of rising prices, therefore meaning that you're squeezing your working class badly. But on top of that, remember that this is a working class that was already squeezed by the pandemic for 2 years and by the economic crash that accompanied the pandemic. So you have a working class that has been relatively losing wealth for 25 years, having gone through a terrible pandemic and crash, to be followed by an inflation, and now to be followed by raising interest rates. This is a country whose level of indebtedness, government debt, corporate debt, and household debt, is higher than ever in the history of this country, by a lot. So raising interest rates is a very serious economic blow on top of the inflation, on top of the pandemic, on top of the crash, and on top of 25 years of wealth redistribution. No working class can exist under such pressure for so long at such a level. And so what you're seeing over the last 12 months in the United States is a rise of the militancy of the labor movement, which is, we've never seen that in 100 years. We are now seeing levels of unionization, of strikes, that bring us back to the 1930s with the worst crash of capitalism in its history. That has to be understood. That's a consequence of all of this. In the midst of this, to deal with the inflation, our government is raising interest rates. That, of course, hurts poor people and middle-income people, small businesses and medium businesses, because for them, a few rising levels of interest rate cripple their ability to function because they have such debts. We are told falsely that this is the only way to deal with the inflation. I do interviews across the United States where I explain to people that the last time we had an inflation like this in the 1980s, our conservative president, Richard Nixon, imposed a wage price freeze overnight, August 15th, 1971, and that solved the inflation problem. Today, we don't do that, but we don't even allow a conversation. We have a society in which the government tells us this is the only way and this is what we're going to do. Okay, what are the consequences? Here's the irony. Raising interest rates is to slow the inflation. Yeah, but the government's expansion of money spent on the war in Ukraine is the opposite. It makes inflation worse. Everyone who's ever studied economics understands that a sudden increase in a government expenditure is inflationary. So we have the government spending more on Ukraine on the one hand and limiting the spending of small and medium households and businesses by raising interest rates. You know what that is? A, contradictory, B, senseless, and C, a not very subtle way of saying we're rearranging the economy. You small and medium-sized businesses, you small and medium-sized households, you're going to have to cut back your consumption so that we can free resources to throw into military production for Ukraine. Who pays for the war as usual? Yeah, but the problem here is that in the United States, making the working class pay coincides with a rising militarization and militancy of our labor movement. That is a very dangerous thing. And you're beginning to see, both on the right wing and on the left, a coming together of neither of whom is happy with this war in Ukraine and the way it is being funded. And the moral argument cannot, never has in this country, and will not now be strong enough to overcome the on-the-ground material problems that I'm talking about.
Left-wing economists usually argue that government spending in the social fabric does not lead necessarily to inflation. How come this is the case that military spending would lead to inflation?
Well, mostly because it's an opportunity for what we call here the military-industrial complex. Let me explain. Many years ago, a wonderful relationship was developed between the military, the government, and the industries that produce the planes, the bullets, the guns, the tanks, and all the rest of it. Very famous President Eisenhower after World War II, when he leaves office as president, makes a famous speech where he warns the American people about the military-industrial complex, which works like this. Very important for people to understand. The government gives contracts to military producers. These are called cost-plus contracts. In other words, the military producer says, it'll cost me $1 million to make that airplane, and therefore I want a contract for $1,100,000 because I need a profit of $100,000, and that's how the contract is written. Okay, so now we permit the military defense producer, we permit them to take whatever steps they want politically. What steps do they take? They support the political candidates who write those contracts for them. So we have a wonderful relationship. Who gets into office? People who are believers in military spending. Why? Because the military contracts who get spent on take a portion of the money they get from the government to donate to the government. What, I mean, this is childish. We've been dominated by that. Every year, including the one we're just finishing now, every year there is a request from the military for a certain amount for the budget for that year. And they typically get many billions of dollars more than they request. Normally, when requests go in, they are reduced a little by the politicians. But in this case, for example, this year, there were tens of billions of dollars allocated to the military, larger than what the Biden administration requested from Congress. And that's usual. That's not unusual. So we have a situation where when the government spends enormously, it is easy for these companies with their long-standing cozy relationships to raise the prices of whatever it is they charge the government for. And since they know they're getting more each year, and since they know they're raising the prices, they can in turn, pay more for their inputs, whether it is sandwiches brought to their workers for lunch, or it's electricity they buy, or it's inputs of iron and steel. In other words, they can percolate, they can spread the inflation throughout the economy. When you remember that the United States federal government is the largest single consumer in the country, and that one third or more of its budget is military, you are giving an enormous inflationary thrust to the economy when you allow this kind of an expansion with all of its ramifications. And when you have a situation of social spending, you have a little of this, but much, much less, because there's no monopoly. There's no social industrial complex that's comparable. The money is spent on working class people, you know, clerks, social workers, all that kind of thing. And they're not in a position to demand higher wages and none of that. So basically, you have the same problem. You are increasing spending, and liberals should not deny that because it's silly. But it's nothing comparable to the structured situation in defense industries. And of course, I say defense only because that's what we call it. Countries with less problems with honesty call it the War Department. But we, of course, can't, because we need to always be pretending, excuse me, advocating that we are in a defense situation.
I would like to examine the Ukrainian economy. It shrank by 30% in 2022. What is not reported with great attention is the role of the IMF in Ukraine. It is estimated somewhere between 40 billion to 57 billion of external financing will be needed by Ukraine this year, including 3 billion that it owes to the IMF itself. This also includes roughly 360 million in surcharges fees alone by 2023. What is the role? Why is the IMF not, when it comes to freedom and democracy, supporting the Ukrainian economy by doing away with these loans and surcharges and just providing free credit?
There's very little economy left in Ukraine. That's the truth. Whatever anybody else tells you, and this is not a critique of Ukraine or anything else. You can't be a little country like that fighting a war you couldn't possibly afford against a huge enemy, better organized, better equipped than you are, and being subject to missile attacks that destroy your infrastructure. I mean, it's over. That is a destroyed economy, whatever the particulars are. You know, they're not that big a country, and they've lost at least 5 to 10 million people that have left the country. I mean, the jobs those people did aren't being done, and on and on and on and on. So I don't think it's not meaningful at this point to talk about the economy of Ukraine, because for all practical purposes, there isn't one. They are getting by. They have to import food. They have to import fuel. They have, you know, their military runs on what comes from outside, literally down to the bullets that they shoot. So I think that you're hearing statements, and the statements, if you listen carefully, the statements can be translated as follows. We have committed everything to this war. We were willing to push it to the point where the Russians threatened us that they would invade. We didn't probably believe they would. We were wrong. They did. And they are doing what a war involves. We cannot survive that situation. So we become totally dependent. If you listen to Mr. Zelensky, they're totally dependent already on a military basis. If you look at what happened to their labor force, to their transportation system, I'm not even talking about the large parts of the country that are now taken over and run by the Russians. What's left for them is chaotic, unable to be repaired, you know, nothing. So what you hear from Zelensky are fantastic estimates. It's going to take, the last one I heard, $600 billion to rebuild. They're making statements like the $300 billion taken from Russia that backed its currency, that money, Zelensky says, should be a first down payment on rebuilding Ukraine to punish Russia for they're desperate. They've committed everything. Mr. Zelensky must know that he will come out of this as a great hero if they can save him. But he will come out as the worst person in the history of Ukraine if this falls apart. He is on the knife edge one way or the other. If this isn't fixed, if they don't get vast amounts of money from the West beyond what's already been given to them to repair the damage of the war, the Ukrainians will be the ones that look back on Mr. Zelensky with horror. And he must know that somewhere. Everybody else who pays attention does. It's a very open question. And this is Mr. Zelensky's nightmare. It's a very open question. Whenever this war ends, and all wars do sooner or later, whenever this war ends, will the countries of Europe and North America be prepared to spend at the same rate to reconstruct that they spent to fight the war? I don't think so. But of course, I can't tell the future any better than anyone else can. But Mr. Zelensky, his life depends on that question and how it gets answered.
Professor Richard Wolff, founder of Democracy at Work, author and economist, thank you so much for your time today.
Professor Richard Wolff. Next, we have Professor Jeffrey Sachs, who, like Wolff, has been an outspoken critic of the U.S. role in Ukraine. And again, the interviewer is Zane Raza of the German online journal The Source.
Thank you guys for tuning in today, and welcome to another episode of The Source. I'm your host, Zane Raza. And today I'll be talking to Professor Jeffrey Sachs about the war in Ukraine. Jeffrey Sachs serves as the director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University, where he holds the title of university professor, the university's highest academic rank. Jeffrey Sachs is also a world-renowned economist, best-selling author, innovative educator, and a global leader in sustainable development. Jeffrey is also known for his work in advising governments worldwide on economic reforms, and as well as working with international agencies on debt, poverty reduction, as well as disease control. Jeffrey Sachs, thank you so much for your time today.
Great to be with you. My pleasure.
Let us move to a fundamental debate that has failed in the German corporate media regarding Ukraine. We have also interviewed a wide range of experts from Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, Vijay Prashad, Peter Kuznick on this matter, so it would be interesting to get your view as well. Denazification and demilitarizations were reasons given by the Russian state to justify its war in Ukraine. Do you think these reasons had any legitimacy?
Look, the core of this is the clash between the United States and Russia. That clash goes back to 1992 when the neoconservatives took over American foreign policy. This was originally Rumsfeld, Cheney, Wolfowitz in the administration of George W. Bush Sr. But there are a lot of neocons around. Madeleine Albright was a neoconservative, Hillary Clinton was a neoconservative, Victoria Nuland, who was Assistant Secretary of State during the Maidan in 2014, is now the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. She's a neoconservative. And so what happened was the U.S. foreign policy, starting in 1992, aimed for U.S. dominance, it's sometimes called full-spectrum dominance, that in every region of the world, the U.S. should be able to blow away, figuratively. I hope its opponents and antagonists, and to have geopolitical dominance through military, financial, economic, technological, and other means. And in 1992, that was the view. And it looked, who could rival us? Russia's down on its knees. China's a poor rural country. Well, of course, it was never realistic. The world's never dominated by one country in all of history, though there have been empires, of course, that are powerful. But there's always going to be rivalry and always multipolarity in some sense, and that's especially true in the 21st century. Russia did not buckle under the U.S. View. China, even less so. I would say both of them say, no, we don't want a U.S.-led unipolar world. Now, the U.S. began to implement this in the 1990s with NATO enlargement. Anyone that knows the archival record knows that it wasn't just a loose verbiage, but it was a decided policy of Germany and the United States to promise to Gorbachev no NATO enlargement to the east, and not just to the east, to GDR, to the east. And so a lot of what's said right now is just typical U.S. government spin. But the archival record is actually very extensive. Then in the mid-1990s, Clinton started saying the same to Yeltsin, I know, that no, we're going to have a partnership system. We're not going to have NATO enlargement. But then Madeleine Albright pushed the neocon agenda. We're expanding NATO. And it created a big division inside the U.S. because there's some normal non-neocons inside the U.S., and I'm one of them, said, no, NATO enlargement is a bad idea. And Bill Perry, who was the Secretary of Defense of Clinton, came close to resigning over this issue. George Kennan, who was our greatest statesman scholar of the 20th century vis-a-vis Russia, said this is the new Cold War. That was back in 1997 that he said that. Then many events followed. The U.S.-led alliance bombed Belgrade in 1999, broke Serbia apart deliberately as part of its geopolitics, and as per neocon ideas, went to war with all of Russia's allies in the Middle East, overthrowing Saddam Hussein, overthrowing Gaddafi, trying to overthrow Assad. So this was a very expansionist period of the U.S., trillions of dollars spent on expansionist wars. And in 2014, the U.S. was part of the successful effort to overthrow Yanukovych. This is absolutely clear, although we don't know every bit. We know a lot, and I know a lot from my own knowledge about these events. The U.S. played a role in overthrowing a president of Ukraine who was basically pro-Russian, but basically trying to keep some kind of stable equilibrium between the two sides through neutrality of Ukraine. Yes, we want Western this. Yes, we want to keep relations with Russia. Very fragile, because the U.S. is pushing NATO enlargement and Russia's saying, hell no. And this is what was happening. And Yanukovych was overthrown and a Western Ukraine, highly nationalist government was brought into power. And at that moment, Putin did what he warned George Bush Jr. he would do at the Bucharest summit in 2008. Putin said George Bush, you expand NATO, we take Crimea back. Don't do it. But the U.S. doesn't listen. So we went to this direct clash, war in the Donbas. And then, you know, sad to say, the Minsk agreements were reached. Germany and France were to be the guarantors. But I don't know if Mrs. Merkel, Chancellor Merkel, is speaking ex post as an excuse or telling what she thought at the time, but it's dreadful. What we do know is that the Ukrainians walked away from the Minsk agreements. After signing, my friends tell me, Jeff, how could you ever expect us to honor that? That's trash. I say, yeah, you have an agreement. Ah, an agreement. And we're supposed to take this with a straight face. And Germany was a solemn guarantor. Uninterested. In the meantime, the U.S. poured in billions of dollars of armaments. By the end of 2021, Putin said to Biden, look, here are the red lines. And the number one red line is NATO enlargement, by far, by the way. And the U.S. said, we're not going to talk about that. Our door is open, which is a ridiculous idea. We're not talking about trade. We're talking about military alliances. What is this open door of military alliances in history? That you don't care who your neighbors are aligned with, where the military bases are, what the weapons are? This is crazy rhetoric, I'm sorry to say. So provocative and dangerous. And the invasion started in February 2022. But the war, everyone should understand, started in February 2014. The war did not start in February 2022. And this is not the West reacting. The United States started in 1992 to break the agreements that it had given to Gorbachev. Why? Because they felt they could. That's it.
I want to go through some counter arguments with you that are usually made. For example, the first part, NATO was also stationed in Poland and Latvia that has borders with Russia and they have coexisted somewhat peacefully. NATO was not planning an intervention. And the second counter argument that is made is Ukraine is an independent and sovereign state and has a right to make military deals with anyone it pleases, including NATO. How would you respond to these two arguments?
I would say that, first of all, NATO is often an aggressive force, almost an expeditionary force of U.S. foreign policy. Bombing Belgrade in 1999 was completely unjustified. The actions that NATO took in Libya, in my opinion, completely unjustified and far exceeded the UN mandate. And the United States foreign policy is based on regime change. So how much trust can there be, especially after events like the Maidan? The United States is not a peace-loving country. It is a power-seeking country. Not surprisingly, perhaps, I'm told by smart cynics, well, isn't that always the case? And maybe it is. But then let's not kid ourselves with the rhetoric that is used. The United States has overthrown dozens of governments. It definitely contributed to the overthrow of Yanukovych. It definitely tried to overthrow al-Assad in Syria and was a major provocation of the war there. And I know this from the inside, not just from the outside. So I just want to be clear that I know from top people involved in these issues what I'm discussing right now. So this is one thing, this idea of this peace-loving da-da-da-da-da is not what a military alliance is. This is a military alliance that serves military and geopolitical purposes. And it should show restraint. In my opinion, by the way, just to put it clearly, when the Warsaw Pact was disbanded by Gorbachev, I think NATO should have ended. That's my own view. We should have gone to OSCE. We should have gone to a European security arrangement. But we didn't, because the neocons in the United States said, okay, now's really our chance. And I was at a conference recently in Eastern Europe where a NATO spokesman came in. It looked almost like a Star Wars event. He was full in uniform and there was a screen in back. And he talked about how NATO plays the vital role in the Black Sea region, and it will be crucial for Eurasia or something like that. I said, oh my God, what is this? It's almost like a cartoon. I don't want to hear that. I was at an economics conference, by the way. I don't want to see NATO officials at an economics conference. So this is really, really an important point. And because this is a military alliance, it's not true that you just get to choose who you have your military alliances. There's a concept called externalities, which is that your choice may have adverse consequences for the one next door. Should the U.S. have a NATO base in the Sea of Azov? Well, Russia doesn't think so. By the way, I don't think so. I don't think it's prudent. And I don't think it's smart of Ukraine to not recognize that it's in a delicate balancing act and should be prudent and careful. And I'm living and experiencing, well, I'm seeing successive neutrality in many places. Let's just put it this way. In my view, you be careful in this world. And you recognize that military alliances are dangerous because they lead to wars often. We should not have these military alliances. We should not be expanding military alliances in Asia to counter China. These are dangerous provocations. If you want really a historical analogy, it is maybe 1910. All these alliances being built. Well, and then a tripwire was crossed in 1914. And the world was never the same again. But let's avoid that.
In December last year, there was a lot of voicing for diplomacy stated by French President Macron, even President Biden. The German Chancellor, for example, even spoke to Putin for an hour on the phone, reportedly. However, the tone has completely shifted since the start of the new year. To begin the new year, NATO General Secretary Jens Stoltenberg said, and I'm quoting him here, "Weapons are, in fact, the way to peace." Now we're seeing all sorts of weapons, from armored vehicles, artillery, Patriot defense systems being committed to Ukraine. And the UK has now upped the ante by sending the Challenger 2 battle tanks. All eyes are on Berlin now. All the pressure is on Berlin. Tomorrow they're meeting. All the defense ministers are meeting at Ramstein Air Base. And it is expected that Germany will at some point capitulate to all this pressure and send also battle tanks known as the Leopard 2. What advice would you give to leaders of this conference if you were participating as well? And do you think advanced offensive weapons could change the tide of war?
The advice I would give to leaders, period, is sit down and start talking. Most importantly, President Biden and President Putin. And how can we have an approach that does not also include negotiations? This is mind-boggling. You see, it's quite interesting. Our top general in the United States, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, said, now is the time to negotiate. The next day, Victoria Nuland, who's our neocon in chief in the State Department, said, no, no negotiations. The whole idea is to bat down at all times any possibility of discussion. The only thing that's allowed in the narrative is war. Negotiations not even to be tried. So aside from all the weapon systems and whatever one thinks, open negotiations. And understand, by the way, and it's quite clear, Chancellor Scholz said to Putin at the beginning of all of this, NATO won't enlarge on my watch. He said, yes, you're Chancellor of Germany. What about NATO itself? How long are you going to be there? And the point is very simple. This is, first of all, a U.S.-led alliance. This is a 30-year U.S. project to expand NATO. President Biden's only words on this are, the door is open. The United States repeats at every occasion that Ukraine will become a member of NATO. What the Europeans could say clearly to Biden is, come on, you have put us in a terrible bind. You're crushing our industry. You're bringing us closer to war, and all over something that should not have happened at all, which was this intention to expand NATO, because when that was put on the table in 2008, Germany was against it. France was against it. I know. I talked to the leaders then. But they don't say it publicly. They don't admit the truth. And then the media obscure all of this history. So my recommendation is open negotiations.
To my last questions, according to the United Nations, 7,000 civilians have been killed since the war started, including 433 children. Most recently, 30 to 40 civilians were killed when a Russian missile hit a high-story building in the city of Dnipro. Given that Russia and even Ukraine are not signatory of the International Criminal Court, German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock recently called for a special tribunal to be set up at The Hague that should pursue Russian leadership for its crimes in Ukraine. So this is a two-part question. A question, should the West play the role of moral authority? And B, will a special tribunal assist in resolving the conflict and bring justice?
No and no. This is just provocation. Let's end this war. Let's understand that both sides are party to this war, that there were tremendous Western provocations, that there are terrible outcomes in wars but committed by both sides, that there is propaganda up the wazoo, as we would say, and hype and so forth. So let's have serious negotiations. And frankly, let's have some diplomacy from Germany. Diplomacy. That means diplomacy to sit down with counterparts in Russia, to talk, to learn, to understand, to find a path to peace.
Jeffrey Sachs, best-selling author and world-renowned economist, thank you so much for your time today.
Great to be with you. I appreciate it.
And thank you guys for tuning in today. Please join our alternative channels on Rumble and Telegram. YouTube is shadow banning our content. Our information will not be able to reach you if you do not make this transition. And also to donate, even if it's just $1 via PayPal or Patreon, your contribution will help us to continue our independent journalism going forward. I'm your host, San Raza. See you guys next time.
That was Professor Jeffrey Sachs speaking with Zane Raza of The Source, based in Munich, Germany. And by this time next week, I'll be on my way to Arizona for my seasonal work. If I don't have a new edition for you then, that will be the reason. But you never know. Either way, I hope you'll tune in and that you'll support these community radio stations, which are WCRS-FM, WCRS-LP-FM, rather, 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRN-LP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. Once again, we can use your support financially to help us move our antennas and transmitters. You can donate at WCRSFM.org. Be with you again next week in one capacity or another. Hope to see you then. Take care.